This is The Guardian.
Today, it's the last refuge for more than a million civilians in Gaza. And now, the Israeli army says it's coming.
Today in Focus is supported by Rainforest Trust. In honour of this year's Earth Day, we're promoting Rainforest Trust's Brazilian Amazon Fund throughout April. Rainforest Trust is a 501c3 organisation, which means that 100% of all money donated goes directly to conservation efforts. The fund has already helped protect more than 6.5 million acres of rainforest habitat, but Rainforest Trust still needs to protect a further 13 million acres to reach its goal. You can help. Donate online at rainforesttrust.org/earthday this April, and your generous gift will be quadruple matched for the Brazilian Amazon.
Yusuf, how are you? How are you doing?
All good, alhamdulillah. Alive.
I'm glad to hear that. Yusuf Hamash is a journalist living in Gaza with his family. I managed to reach him this week on a really bad line. Tell me, I mean, where are you right now?
So currently I'm displaced in Rafah, in the southern part of Gaza Strip.
Yusuf is one of more than a million people pressed into a tiny city at the southern edge of the Gaza Strip called Rafah, the last area considered even remotely safe from Israel's military campaign. And what does it look like right now to walk through Rafah at the moment? What do you see and hear around you?
It used to have 250,000 citizens. In a matter of a few days, the population became more than 1.5 million.
Wow.
All of that in tents and makeshift shelters.
What does that look like to be in a place where the population has increased by 4 or 5 times in just a matter of weeks?
Every day it became more challenging, and access to your basic needs became more difficult because Rafah infrastructure itself is not prepared. Rafah doesn't have a main hospital. The biggest hospital we had in Rafah, it contained 60 beds for 60 patients.
And there's over 1 million people there.
Exactly, and a mass spread of disease among displaced families because lack of clean water, it's rare to get a shower, especially if you are in a tent. If you are lucky, you will take a shower once a week. Every day, families are trying to manage and to provide their daily needs for their children and their families. But unfortunately, this mission is getting more impossible every day with the amount of people who are coming on a daily basis.
As people continue to pour in from destroyed cities across the Gaza Strip, a new threat has emerged. Israel says to defeat Hamas, it needs to invade Rafah. For Yusuf and so many others, it's deja vu. He's already fled 3 other places with his wife and kids. And what kinds of calculations are you making? If the Israeli offensive begins in Rafah, where do you plan to go? Where can you go?
That's a good question. There is no place that we can go. We are going through an unimaginable situation.
From The Guardian, I'm Michael Safi. Today in Focus, will Israel invade Rafah? Ruth Michelson, you're a foreign correspondent and you've covered this now 4-month-long war for The Guardian. How did we get to this point?
So after the 7th of October, when we saw that Hamas militants stormed the area around the border with the Gaza Strip and killed an estimated 1,200 Israelis, most of them civilians. They also took hostages and took them back into Gaza. Israeli forces began an intense bombing campaign of Gaza and especially Gaza City.
Now to Israel's war with Hamas. There are breaking developments to get to tonight. Israeli Defense Forces are calling on all residents of northern Gaza to evacuate their homes within 24 hours.
And then in mid-October, Israeli forces ordered over a million people who were in Gaza City to move south. South of the Gaza River.
People living in northern Gaza have received phone alerts advising them to evacuate their homes within 24 hours. That ominous warning from Israel's military saying residents should leave for their own safety.
Since the ground invasion of the Gaza Strip, Israeli forces have pushed civilians further and further south in Gaza. Many, many people went to Khan Yunis, which is the largest city at the southern end of the Strip. And then we saw that Israeli ground forces entered Khan Yunis in December.
The Israeli army renewed calls for evacuations. Some of those taking flight in Khan Yunis headed to Mawasi on the southern Gazan coast, which Israel has designated a humanitarian zone.
As a result of that, tens of thousands of people fled Khan Yunis for Rafah, the southernmost city in the Gaza Strip. It's right next to the border with Egypt.
Ruth, you've described this dynamic where civilians are pushed from one place to the next, told every time that that next place is safe until it isn't, until Israel starts bombing it or Israeli troops start invading it. And slowly, slowly, people have been pushed into this very last civilian enclave, Rafah. And now it looks like the Israelis are headed for that too.
The Israeli army and the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, have certainly made statements that suggest that's the case.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has told his military to prepare for an evacuation of the city of Rafah inside Gaza ahead of an expected Israeli invasion there.
Last Friday, Netanyahu's office released about a three-line statement that just said it is impossible to achieve the goal of the war without eliminating Hamas. And by leaving what they described as four Hamas battalions in Rafah, his office then said, you know, it's clear that intense activity in Rafah requires that civilians evacuate the areas of combat. And they added that Netanyahu had ordered the IDF, the Israeli military, as well as the Israeli security establishment, to submit plans to the cabinet to evacuate the civilian population in Rafah and to essentially draw up a battle plan for invading the city.
That's dominated the conversation for the last few days, the chances of a ceasefire. But now Israel is saying it wants to launch an incursion into Rafah.
And then what have we seen there over the past few days?
So just a couple of days after that announcement, we saw that Israel drastically scaled up airstrikes on Rafah.
We begin in southern Gaza, where the Israeli military has carried out overnight attacks on the city of Rafah.
Sunday night and in well into Monday morning, people described that airstrikes were still happening at 7 a.m. on Monday, after going on all night.
Multiple strikes targeted the vicinity of the Kuwait hospital, and crowds of injured Palestinians, including children, have streamed into the overburdened facility.
The Israeli military said that this was a diversion, that they were rescuing two hostages who were in a civilian house in Rafah.
I'm very happy to announce that this night, two released hostages landed here at Sheba Medical Center, Israel's largest hospital.
Those airstrikes also killed at least 67 people in Rafah. Other estimates put that number higher. They said it was over 100 people. And the loss of human life when you have airstrikes of that intensity, or any airstrikes, is about how many people are just crammed into Rafah at the moment. Estimates that we have from the UN are that there's over half of Gaza's total population, that's 2.3 million people, are now crammed into this area, which is 62 square miles.
Incredible.
It's quite hard to comprehend, right? And it's over 1.3 million people And what we know is that they are sleeping mostly in makeshift tents. There are people sleeping on the streets, according to the UN, because they have arrived fleeing from other places and they haven't been able to find tents because there's just so many people looking for shelter. This is in a city that used to have just 300,000 people, in a place that is now increasingly coming under attack.
Ruth, you said that Benjamin Netanyahu had issued an evacuation order for Rafah. Evacuate to where? How do you evacuate that many people and where do they go?
I mean, that is an extremely good question in this environment, especially when it's over 1.3 million people that have just been pushed further and further south.
Our team in Gaza tells us that the Israeli military has given people several options. Move to an already overcrowded part of Rafah, go to Khan Yunus, which is still being bombed, or return to the north, which has been all but obliterated.
There are people who have now fled north up the coastal road, which runs along the beach in the Gaza Strip. And they are fleeing to areas like Deir al-Balah and Nusayrat, which are in the so-called middle area. And these are people who were already displaced four or five times, maybe even more, before they got to Rafah. They are now fleeing again. And they are also fleeing to an area that is also under bombardment. There have been intense airstrikes in recent weeks on that part of Gaza as well. And there are others who say that they are unable or unwilling to flee, that they fear that there won't be anywhere for them to go in Deir al-Balah. And they are stuck at the southernmost point of the Gaza Strip. It is right next to the Egyptian border. And we've seen that that border is also increasingly being fortified with barbed wire, with a security presence on the Egyptian side. And Egypt has quite openly expressed fears that Israeli forces pushing into Rafah could provoke Palestinians to try and rush across that border into the Sinai Peninsula, which is on the other side.
Mm. Have the Israelis actually put forward a plan, something that looks like a credible evacuation plan that might give people some safety?
We haven't seen any public evidence of that yet. We don't know what plans have been submitted to the cabinet as Netanyahu demanded. When I went to the IDF for comment earlier this week to ask about whether they would suggest evacuation routes for Rafah, they did not respond.
They can't just disappear. Where are they supposed to go?
No, well, the areas that we've cleared north of Rafah, are plenty of areas there, but we are working out a detailed plan to do so.
Based on what we have seen so far in other parts of Gaza, it's also possible that the plan that will be submitted is not necessarily going to be sufficient to actually ensure people's safety. There is evidence that when Israeli forces proposed what they said were designated safe routes out of Gaza City south, they also attacked those safe routes. And so the plan that has to be put forward has to be one that people on the ground feel comfortable using, and that's also questionable.
I am currently displaced with my family in the city of Rafah, in the southern part of the Gaza Strip.
One of the people trapped in Rafah, trying to figure out what they might do if Israel invades, is Asil Musa, a freelance journalist. She was able to send us a few messages yesterday.
My family and I have been enduring the most challenging days of our lives. On October 13, the Israeli authorities ordered us to evacuate the northern Gaza Strip and relocate to the south in Al-Maghazi refugee camp, where Israel claimed it to be a safe area. We experienced relentless bombardment. Israel bombed the only bakery and schools that were shelters for the displaced civilians. Israel killed 60 members of my family. Most of them were children and women. and they were in areas that were classified as safe by the occupation. After almost 80 days of displacement in Al-Maghazi, my family and I were forced to relocate once again. Israel claimed that Rafah is a safe area. Actually, the situation is getting harder every passing day. On Monday night, the Israeli occupation unleashed a barrage of missiles and artillery shells on the city. The prospect of a ground invasion into Rafah would be catastrophic. I actually feel utterly helpless. There's nowhere safe left to go.
Ruth, we've just heard Asil's story, one of so many people in that situation in Rafah. Why are the Israelis saying they need to do this, to go into this very last place in Gaza that people feel any kind of safety?
So we've certainly seen plenty of statements from Israeli officials saying that this is a necessity to go after Hamas.
Those who say that under no circumstances should we enter Rafah are basically saying, lose the war, keep Hamas there. And Hamas's promise to do the October 7th massacre over and over and over again.
The idea is that they are squeezing, in the Israeli forces' conception of this, that they are squeezing Hamas into these tighter and tighter spaces, and that they would then be able to eliminate the leadership or other Hamas fighters.
They did say that they had a number of objectives, and one of those was identifying Yahya Sinwar, finding him, tracking him down, and taking him into custody or neutralizing him, the leader of Hamas in Gaza. And so far that has not happened. So presumably the IDF thinks that they might find him in the Rafah area. That remains to be seen. So look, we'll see.
We don't necessarily have a lot of evidence that that strategy has been effective so far, or that it will be any more effective in Rafah than it was elsewhere. These are also things that the Israelis said about Khan Yunis and areas of Gaza City before they sent ground troops into those places too.
So you're saying that these big goals that Netanyahu set out at the start of the war, to rescue the hostages and to defeat Hamas, we don't actually know if that's working or not.
I think it's fair to say that there are major questions about the success of that strategy. So starting with the estimations of the number of Hamas fighters that have been killed, according to some reports that came out in the Wall Street Journal and some other publications citing US intelligence at the end of January, they said that Israel had killed around 20 to 30% of Hamas's fighters. And I think the other thing to consider is that what Netanyahu said that Israel is setting out to do is to completely eradicate the leadership of Hamas. And we don't necessarily have any evidence that that has been achieved in any sense. And so I think there are major questions about whether Israel has achieved what it said, or particularly what Netanyahu said it was going to achieve with this incredibly aggressive campaign of strikes and the presence of ground forces in Gaza. We know that much of Gaza's infrastructure is entirely destroyed. We know that 28,000 people are now dead. And there is nowhere for people to return to in the north. There are meant to be thousands more bodies under the rubble. And we also know that Hamas are regrouping in parts of the north. So there are major questions about whether a push into Rafah is going to be in any way decisive, or whether it would just simply be more of what we've seen so far.
So Ruth, how has this plan to push into Rafah, potentially at huge civilian cost, played out among Israel's biggest allies?
So we saw that the US President Joe Biden, who has certainly expressed support for Israel's operation in Gaza following the October 7th attacks, that the threat that Israel could attack Rafah seems to be raising some alarm. Joe Biden told Netanyahu in a phone call on Sunday that the Israelis should not launch any military operation in Rafah, in his words, without a credible and executable plan for ensuring the safety and support for more than 1 million people sheltering there. And the airstrikes that took place on Sunday night and well into Monday morning occurred after that call. So it's not necessarily clear that Netanyahu or the Israeli defense establishment has necessarily taken that warning immediately on board.
Mr. Prime Minister, let me ask you right away, what's your response to President Biden saying that your response in Gaza has been over the top?
Well, I appreciate President Biden's support for Israel since the beginning of the war. I don't know exactly what he meant by that, but
we've seen that other Western allies of Israel have started to express real concerns about what an attack on Rafah would mean.
Well, we are very concerned about what is happening in Rafah.
David Cameron said on Tuesday, it's just simply not possible for many people to leave Rafah. So really underscoring this idea that even with a plan put in place for people to be able to leave the city, in David Cameron's words, they can't go north because they'd be going back home to homes that have been destroyed.
Let's be clear, the people there, many of them have moved four, five, six times before getting there. And it really, we think, is impossible to see how you can fight a war amongst these people. There's nowhere for them to go.
We also saw a warning by Martin Griffiths, who's the UN Undersecretary for Humanitarian Affairs. Really grim statement from him saying, the scenario we have long dreaded is unravelling at alarming speed. He said that people in Rafah are staring death in the face. He pointed at the fact that there is already a massive shortage of food. There's fears that an attack on Rafah would cut access for over 1 million people, just in Rafah alone and more beyond that, to what tiny amount of aid is already getting in through the Rafah crossing. And so Martin Griffiths said that he is, in his words, sounding the alarm, and that a military operation in Rafah could lead to a slaughter in Gaza.
Throughout the past 4 months, we've heard the UN express those kinds of fears. But what I'm wondering is, the things expressed by Joe Biden, by David Cameron, are they any different to what they've said over the past few months? Are they trying to draw a line here where if Israel does this, they might actually do something meaningful, like in the US case, no longer sending the weapons that are enabling this campaign?
I think there's a real effort to draw a line. I mean, we certainly saw in the statements from David Cameron that where things are at the moment has to be the end, and that the Israelis need to stop and think before going ahead with any operations and wrap up. I'm not really sure what wrap up means, but it doesn't sound like he's encouraging them to push ahead.
U.S. Senate has passed a $95 billion aid package for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. It's now been sent to...
At the same time, there's not necessarily, as you say, the threat that if Israeli forces did push into Rafah and did cause this level of harm, that there would be a pause to weapons supplies.
$14 billion in military aid for Israel is included in that bill.
Coming up, people in Rafah can't go north. Why they can't flee south to Egypt either.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And Ruth, you said that one of the things happening in Rafah is that its border with Egypt is being fortified. Egyptian troops are gathering, barbed wire is being strung over the fence. You're a former Cairo correspondent. Explain to me why the Egyptians couldn't just let the Palestinians there into the country temporarily for their safety.
Well, this has certainly been the question for a long time. And there is immense pressure on Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, the Egyptian president, internally to do more to protect people in Gaza, and particularly to open the Rafah crossing, which Egypt nominally controls between the northern Sinai and Gaza. Sisi has certainly sounded the alarm plenty of times about the idea of what could happen if millions of Palestinians flee into the Sinai. And when he has made public statements about this, he has described the presence of 2 million Palestinians sheltering in the Sinai as though that would be a security threat to Cairo in some way, which has been conducting military operations against jihadist militants in the northern Sinai Peninsula for about a decade. But Egypt has also said that they don't want the Sinai to become similar to situations that we've seen in Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon or in Syria, or the long-term presence of Palestinian refugees in Jordan, for example. And so the fear from Cairo is that any Palestinians displaced into the Sinai, that this will not be temporary, that they will never actually be allowed to go back, and that Egypt will in the long term become responsible for them in a way that Sisi does not want Egypt to be.
An invasion of Rafah would be a humanitarian disaster for the Palestinian people there, but potentially also a diplomatic disaster for the Israelis. And it's part of this Israeli strategy in Gaza that you say may not even be working. It may not even be achieving the goals that Benjamin Netanyahu set out at the beginning of the war, all of which raises the question, why are they doing it?
There's very little evidence that this incredibly aggressive bombing campaign and ground invasion has done what Israel said it set out to do. And we know that any attack on Rafah is going to incur not just a huge loss of civilian life, but increase the already huge loss of civilian life, quite possibly more intensely than we have seen so far. And it seems as though the Israeli authorities are stuck with this idea that the only solution is this very brutal and intense military attack, even if this hasn't brought the results they claim so far, and it seems very unlikely to in future.
Ruth, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that was Ruth Michelson, a foreign correspondent covering this war for The Guardian. Thanks also to Yusuf Hamash and Asil Musa. We're hoping they and their families and everybody trapped in Rafah right now can somehow stay safe. We're covering events in Gaza live and have been since Hamas's October 7 attacks on Israel. All of that coverage is at theguardian.com. And that is it for today. This episode was produced by Sammy Kent and Ned Carter-Miles. Sound design was by Rudy Zagadlo. The executive producer was Elizabeth Casson, and we're back with you tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforminghigher education. This message was paid for by EY.